Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a September 16, 2008 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us today is President of the Northwest Chapter of the American Hydrogen Association, and that would be Abe Foy. Or Foy, is that correct pronunciation, Abe?
Foy.
Oh, very good. And welcome to the program.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, James.
And so we have a half an hour to discuss your interest in hydrogen technology and how you got acquainted with it and what you're doing with it at this time. You are president of the Northwest Chapter of the American Hydrogen Association, which I believe is based in Arizona. Is that not so?
Well, the headquarters is in Arizona. We're up in Portland.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
And so how was it that you originally got interested in hydrogen technology and then acquainted with the or associated with the American Hydrogen Association?
Well, I guess, you know, like a lot of guys, I was 17 and I was going through my chemistry class and we were doing an experiment where we were putting electricity into water and making hydrogen and oxygen. And I was thinking to myself, wow, man, that would be really cool if we could put that into a car. And so I searched the net for, you know, months and months trying to find everything I could and wasn't really finding a whole lot. So I called, I found the American Hydrogen Association and talked to Roy McAllister, and he really helped to give me a lot of really good information and, you know, was saying at the time I had no idea about boosters or any of this kind of stuff, and he was saying, well, you know, for 100% hydrogen, it's going to be kind of difficult because it takes a whole lot of energy to be able to make that hydrogen to power your car. So what we end up doing on our cars is we have compressed tanks and we make hydrogen that way externally, and we compress it and put it in the car, and it runs great. And man, I was so excited. Just couldn't wait. And he had a class that was just about ready to be taught. And there was a chapter starting up here in Eugene, which is the organization we're running now, that Paul Anderson, who's in the group with me, he was running. And I went down to go to a class, and they were telling me, oh, you can make hydrogen from renewables, you can make it from biomass, you can store it in all these really great ways, you can run it in cars and generators, and you can put it through your house. And man, I was so excited. I just got hooked. So I've been doing it for about 10 years now, and we've been building demonstrations and teaching classes and building curriculums and for ourselves and also for schools and for universities and teaching, helping high school kids with their science projects and all this kind of stuff. And it's been a whole hell of a lot of fun, and it's amazing. It's
okay,
really
so
fun stuff.
Your career then, your day job, has to do with computers, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm a systems administrator.
So. Okay. So your interest in hydrogen technology is really a deviation from your career path, but like many other people, concern over the cost, both in economic and environmental terms, of the energy that we use has caused you to become a real pioneer, if you will, in the hydrogen technology field. Because, I mean, how many other people are pursuing hydrogen as an alternate source of energy for mankind's needs?
Well, there definitely needs to be more.
Yeah, it's not that common. And so, and especially when you think of how common hydrogen is as an element. I mean, they say that 97% of the universe is made of it. And you know, water covers the planet, and 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. So a large part of what covers this planet is hydrogen.
Yep, along with all the biomass and all of the waste that just goes up into the air, we could capture that and actually make energy from it.
Yeah, and so that's what we want to talk about. Now, there is a discrepancy between your original goal when you were in your high school chemistry class and you first saw electrolysis demonstrated and you had the dream of running a car on that explosive gas coming out of that electrolyzer.
Yeah.
And then your contact with Roy McAllister and with others involved with hydrogen made you realize or made you come to the realization, according to the conventional wisdom, that it just can't be done. That's the view that is held by most people in academia and certainly anyone involved in the energy industry. They never speak of hydrogen as anything more than an energy carrier that requires more energy to produce than what you get out of it.
Yeah, that's generally the consensus, you know. And you know, kind of what I go with that, you know, when people are telling me, well, you know, hydrogen is just a energy carrier is, you know, so that's just the definition of a fuel. I mean, any, whether it's coal or gasoline or diesel or any of that stuff, it just carries energy. It doesn't,
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, solar energy is converted into these other, it all eventually comes from the sun, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, we can't get away from that.
Whether it's wind or whether it's, the direct sunlight
or it's just radiant energy that people are talking about, you know. Even if it's the EMF, the back, whatever you want to call it, the sea of energy that it seems to all still emanate from outer space and comes from solar hydrogen, really, ultimately, or the reaction there.
And, so, you know, just kind of to talk to you guys about one of the other things there, too, is the conventional wisdom is, you know, that you're not able to use the, that electrolysis is the way to go, but unfortunately, you know, it takes, for most electrolyzers, it takes like 50 kilowatts to produce a gallon equivalent of hydrogen, just because of the inefficiencies of the electrolyzer. But there's been a ton of guys on the net who have been trying to do some Stanley Meyer pulse injection with harmonic frequency stuff. And, you know, my view on it is I've never tested it, so I have no idea if it works. So I can't say it does or it doesn't. But if people are testing it and they find that it works, that's great, you know. You get, if you're able to get something that works, you know, that would be an amazing technology that we can use. So
yeah, and when we say
just because other people don't believe it, still
yeah,
do.
When we say if and we talk about a future demonstration being necessary to convince us, we're ignoring all the evidence that's already been presented over the past, you know, 100 and some years. I mean, these public demonstrations of water fuel devices have taken place over and over again, decade after decade. And the inventors have actually died of old age without their invention having been accepted by the military-industrial complex or the corporate world with its manufacturing infrastructure. All these things could have been embraced and could have been implemented. And we're talking, I mean, the Garrett carburetor goes back to the 1930s. That was publicly demonstrated in Dallas, Texas, really well-respected inventor Henry Garrett and his son Charles. It was in Popular Mechanics or Mechanics Illustrated, an article, a write-up on it. There was quite a bit of write-up in the Dallas Morning News, and that's, you know, and of course Stanley Meyer being much more recently on the scene, and his work went on for almost two decades without any official acceptance by government or industry, although, mm-hmm. you know.
Although he was getting funded, at the end there to see if it actually does work, and you know, so you know, and then he had he had a death, and so there's been a lot of lingering stuff like, well, did they find something that they didn't want to see, or was this was it truly an accident, or what happened there?
Well, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that Stanley Meyer's initial research into using high voltage, I guess, heat, voltage potential, I guess you'd call it, or you're not really using the voltage, but it's present as a potential to break the water molecule apart. And then his technology morphed into other things. I had acquaintance with one of his associates who died just earlier this year. His name was Charlie Holbrook. And he showed me a picture of some kind of, I mean, it looked like some kind of nuclear reaction going on underwater. It looked like the roots of a bush or something. It was like an electric arc, but it looked like a bare root of a plant. And he said, I've seen this taking place in water. It's a very unusual picture. And so Meyer's research started with the goal of just being able to break water down, use it as a source of fuel, you know, to help
sure.
America out of its fossil fuel dependence, the weak position that the United States has been in. But it morphed into more complex areas of energy production from water. And, of course, ultimately he came up with the spark plug, the injector spark plug, that also, it both created and fired the fuel simultaneously as it passed through a tube into the combustion chamber of an engine. So when you're talking about his work, you have to realize it comes in different phases, right? Over the years,
sure.
the 20 years that he was doing it, he continued to pursue advanced utilization of water as a source of fuel. But with regard to your knowledge of how difficult it's been, even for people offering conventional type fuels such as propane or natural gas, you related to me the other day your acquaintance with some people that were involved in promoting those kinds of alternate fuel systems over the past 20 years or more and what they ran into. Would you like to relate that?
Yeah. I was talking to, over the years, we probably talked to, probably 12 or more guys who actually had natural gas and hydrogen and propane conversion shops that they would be converting regular gas, gasoline engines and high-boosting diesel engines to make them run on these other fuels. And, man, they were getting a ton of business, you know. After the first energy crisis, people started to wake up and they were going gung-ho for these alternatives. And so it sprang business, you know. There was a lot of people interested. People were willing to pay for it because they knew that the fuel won't be around forever. And so they were doing real good business for, for about 5, 6 or more years, and then depend on when they started. And then the EPA created a law that has the tampering law in there, along with other regulations of the engines, partially due to people doing inappropriate work. You know, they were doing kind of shoddy work, used tanks that they knew they probably shouldn't be putting in there. But instead of just punishing the people who did the bad work, they just made a federal mandate. You can't do it anymore unless you get approval by us. And we're going to set up a certification program where you got to spend $20,000 an engine to be able to make sure that this stuff actually works. And you need to get trained by us, the government, to be able to do this training. And the government was getting recommendations from other professionals, and they were actually doing the training. So, and a lot of these guys knew as much or more in some cases of what these professionals knew about their technology. And so they were getting told what to do by them, and just overall they had to pay lots and lots of money until there was so much red tape, essentially, that they a ton of them went out of business, where now there's only a handful of guys who actually do it. There's probably, maybe 50 guys, while there was 50 guys in one state before. So it's kind of a sad development, and I think that those laws need to be changed and they need to be overturned to make something that isn't going to do the same thing for this second wave of greenness that's coming through.
Yeah, now, regarding this first wave, you were commenting that the fuel systems that these people were installing for LP or natural compressed natural gas, they were producing less pollution and they had greater economy, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In a lot of cases with the fuel injection systems, not so much with the carburation, but, you know, as systems developed and got better, they were able to use the fuel injection systems on them, and they were able to get more horsepower, more torque, and more fuel economy out of them. And if not, you know, and if they had diminished returns, you know, it was 3%, you know, barely noticeable.
But again, the pollution level would be greatly reduced, even if there was a diminished power or acceleration or whatever, huh?
Oh, yeah. Natural gas, you're looking at a minimum of, you know, with propane, you're probably looking at a minimum of 20%. Natural gas, a minimum of 30, but more like 60% reduction. And hydrogen, you know, you're getting zero, nearly zero or negative, depending on, you know, AHA actually goes for the negative because we have tests that show that running hydrogen in your engine will clean the pollution out of the air while you're driving due to the
okay.
high combustion temperature. But
so we're saying then that a car, or figure when you're on a 10-lane interstate or something, every one of those vehicles that's surrounding you during rush hour could be like a vacuum cleaner cleaning up the atmosphere.
Absolutely, yep.
Actually cleaning the atmosphere instead of zero pollution, we're talking about negative pollution, taking air pollution out of the air.
That's right.
Yeah, the average person is totally unaware of that possibility.
And it's a very good solution too. You know, if we're able to, part of the problem is our transportation. We've had 800 million cars that have caused pollution. If we can turn 800 million cars into machines that actually clean the air as we're driving, man, we can reverse a lot of this damage that we've done in the first place.
In short order. Because
you
have zero pollution coming out of the vehicles, and instead they're now cleaning the atmosphere.
That's right.
Yeah, that's amazing,
and,
isn't it?
And we have a test that was down in Arizona where, where it cleaned about 300% of the hydrocarbons and CO2 out of the air. Actually, the CO2 didn't register, but the hydrocarbons out of the air at idle, and about 600% at full throttle. So you can clean 600% of what's in the air out of there and be able to be left with nearly 9 parts per million if you were starting at 28 parts per million driving your car. Not doing anything different.
Very interesting. Well, you know, cars use a tremendous volume of air, the number of cubic feet per minute that pass through an engine. So you really are acting like a vacuum cleaner then, your vehicle is, as it drives, sucking in the ambient air. If it's going to be, as you say, burning it in a hydrogen fuel mixture, which then, because of its characteristics, is capable of cleaning up that ambient air as it passes through the engine, through the combustion cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it also works for, not just for transportation, but anything that's burning. I mean, if you have hydrogen that's burning in your house, or hydrogen that's burning in, you know, a lot of people are talking about airborne or indoor air pollution as being a huge problem. You're actually, the flame that's coming out of that is also doing the same thing as the engine is. So you're able to, you're not going to be putting out emissions into your house and making you become unhealthy. It's actually going to be, you know, cleaning what was in there already and just emitting water. If you're running a generator, it's going to be doing the same thing. So it's a, even that key aspect is something awesome. And then you can produce all the fuel renewably with our solar, wind, you know, hydropower, you know, and biomass that we're just throwing away right now. We can completely be an energy exporter instead of an energy importer and be able to cut ties with anybody that doesn't have the interests that we want and be able to generate some income and make some wellness for our, for the states and for the world. You know, this, I don't think it needs to be just a, you know, not United States thing. It has to happen all over the place. You know, Iceland has a really good idea of saying, well, in 2020, our entire country is going to be running on hydrogen. All our cars, all our buildings, and it's all going to be made from geothermal and wind. If we had that kind of policy here, holy crap, can you think what we would be able to do?
Well, yeah, that's quite an interesting subject, because apparently there's been some official opposition to this kind of scenario, and it has to do with the U.S. dollar being based on a petroleum economy and the international trading in petroleum being in dollars. And so there's been a secret opposition to shifting away from that scenario for economic reasons.
Oh, yeah. Well, when they make $1 trillion a year off of protecting oil, I would see a big conflict of interest there too.
Yeah, so you know, it's a rat's nest of filthy lucre, you know, and then the trying to preserve the current system as it is, although the current system doesn't seem to be working very well in view of the economic news over the past couple of days. But there have been quite a few articles appearing in financial magazines about how this green revolution, the green technology, the need for clean energy and the need for cheaper energy is going to create its own economy, which could help to offset the failure of the old economy. You know,
and it will help to stabilize our prices. One of the things we were talking about before was this hydrogen home that I'm building. And if everybody had a hydrogen home in this system where they had a 6-kilowatt solar array on their house and a 5-kilowatt electrolyzer, they'd be able to use all of the solar power to power all their electricity, create enough hydrogen to power 2 sedans or minivans or, you know, any vehicle, a truck, and be able to drive on those negative emissions, be able to go 200 to 250 miles per tank with the newer tanks. And the system that I'm putting in is going to be about $60,000, but Oregon has this really great program where I get nearly 50% of it back, 43% plus other tax credits. So I'm going to be spending about $28,000 on my system after all the tax credits. And I figure that when I run this off of completely solar renewable energy, that I'll be making my fuel for $1.45 a gallon. And after I pay that system off in 30 years, I can give this to my kids or, you know, hopefully I'll still be alive by then. Because, you know, I'm only 28 right now, so I got a little bit of time in me. That I'll be able to have that fuel being made with maintenance costs built in for 40 cents a gallon.
Wow.
So I'd be able to run my entire house, all my cars, drive several hundred, you know, the regular 12,000 miles a year per vehicle, and pay under $500 a year.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And that's at current prices. That's because the $60,000 represents the higher cost of the equipment, because it isn't really that common. It's not being mass produced like it should be.
That's right. If we could mass produce them like a toaster and we were able to sell them for a couple thousand bucks, oh man.
Yeah. Well, or what about the shingles? I mean, the shingles on a house should be photovoltaic. Why have a roof on a home that's exposed to the sun all day that is not a photovoltaic cell?
Yeah.
And so you kill two birds with one stone there. Of course, there are vested interests that don't want to see asphalt. Again, it gets back to petrochemical. You know, they got asphalt shingles.
Right.
Even the shingles are made from oil, you know?
And nearly everything, you know, nearly everything that we have in our house.
Yeah. And so, but really, if you can bring the cost down to where it's not even $60,000, not even $30,000, you know, why couldn't you have a system that's only $5,000? You know, similar to your heating and cooling system. You go to buy a new heat pump or something, the entire system is about $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then there's the cost of a mechanic to install it and so on. But
something that's really great that a lot of people don't realize with as far as the mechanic aspect goes is people will charge you a pretty nominal fee, you know, maybe $1,000 to put the stuff in. But after all of the units are built and after all of the technology is mass-produced, I mean, even now when you buy an electrolyzer, it's not a very complicated thing because everything is built into the box. So you have a hose for your water, and you have a hose that goes out for your pressure that goes into your compressor. So it's just a matter of plumbing. If you can do standard plumbing, you can do this stuff too.
Yeah, it's not that difficult, is it?
No.
But it's sure encouraging to hear that someone like yourself is doing this. Other people have done it too. I don't know if you're familiar with Mike Strisky in New Jersey. He has a hydrogen home.
No, I hadn't heard of him. Uh-uh.
Yeah, I did an interview with him last year. And then Cliff Ricketts is a professor of agriculture at Middle Tennessee State University, and he's been producing hydrogen from solar panels for quite some time.
Man, that's just great.
Well, we'd certainly like to know more about it, and our time is up for today, but why don't we keep checking with you as you get this system installed? Have you actually begun the gathering of the materials, or...?
At this point, I've actually, I have to get the plan to get the tax credit. I have to get the plan approved by the DOE, the Oregon DOE.
Okay.
So I'm still in the process of getting all that stuff.
Well, you know, maybe it would help you to achieve that, getting in touch with these other folks like Cliff Ricketts or Mike Strisky, and some of the engineering approval that they receive perhaps could be presented along with your application.
If you are able to send me some of their information, I'd love to get a hold of them. The more collaboration we have, the best.
The Blog Talk Radio site, and on their search box on their site, type in water fuel, and all the interviews that I've done will show up. And you'll see at least Mike Strisky's included there. As far as Cliff Ricketts go, if you type in MTSU, that's Middle Tennessee State University, on a word search, and Cliff Ricketts, R-I-C-K-E-T-T-S, you'll find contact information. He's in the agriculture department.
Okay.
And both
and
of them...
What was the university again?
Middle Tennessee State University.
Okay.
And in fact, the DVD that I include with my book has an interview that Mr. Ricketts, Professor Ricketts, conducted with Herman Anderson about a water-powered car. So he's the man conducting that interview from about 12 years ago.
Well, that's awesome. I'll definitely get a hold of these guys. And something I thought I'd throw out here just before we take off for the day is I'd really like to talk to anybody else who is interested in this stuff. You know, anybody, if you guys just want to call me, you can reach me at 971-227-9007. Email's abe@ahanw.org. The more collaboration that we can get where we're all working with this stuff, we can start groups together and have our groups work together and build something really great. I mean,
very true. What I'll do, I'll put your contact email on the Blog Talk Radio site so anyone going to this show will be able to see it there and get in touch with you.
That'd be great.
Well, Abe, thanks so much for your time and sharing this information with our listening audience. Look forward to getting an update on how your hydrogen home is coming along.
That sounds wonderful. Thanks a lot,
right.
James.
Thank you, and thank everyone for tuning in. Goodbye.